The opinions expressed are those of the program hosts and guests and are not those of WPSL's staff, management, or sponsors. WPSL does not endorse products that may be mentioned. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited without written consent of WPSL. It's time now for the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour, and here's your host, attorney Michael Raybuck.
Good morning. Happy Friday to you. This is Michael Raybuck. You're listening to Raybuck Law Firm Radio on AM 1590 WPSL. I'm chief counsel at my firm, Michael Todd Raybuck, PA, and we are located at 1025 Southwest Martin Downs Boulevard in Palm City, Florida. We're going to focus on two areas of practice in my firm: family law, which are issues related to simple and complex divorce, spousal support and alimony, paternity issues, enforcement, modification, complex litigation, and children's issues that include dependency. We also handle personal injury litigation, where we represent clients who've been injured in auto accidents and negligence cases. Of course, I'm licensed by the Florida Bar. I'm also certified by the Supreme Court of Florida as a family law mediator. I'm admitted to practice in all of the federal courts in Florida, the Northern, Middle, and Southern districts, as well as the U.S. Tax Court. For the next hour, our focus is going to be on family law issues. Phone lines are open at 340-1590. Otherwise, if you just want to listen to the information that we share, but you still may have a question about a family law matter or perhaps a personal injury case or maybe even something like something generally civil or a real estate matter, call me at the office. My telephone number there is 772-600-8166. I'll be glad to schedule a free consultation for you or speak to you personally on the phone regarding your case. You may also email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com. Visit our website at thefamilylawattorney.net. I may also be emailed via the website. We have links there to Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, and now Raybuck Radio replays. I'm hearing a rumor that the YouTube videos are about to be forever videos on the internet, so I will update you on those as well in the coming weeks.
Cool.
All right. Good morning, Veronica.
Good morning.
Good to have you with me as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right. Also, I wanted to remind everyone, I've been asked a couple times as a result of this radio hour to do speaking engagements for organizations regarding something that they have put together. And so if you're interested in having a family attorney do a speaking engagement or perhaps be one of a panel of speakers, don't hesitate to contact me to inquire about that because I'll be happy to do that. It's very interesting and something that I will be more than happy to investigate with you and to speak for you in front of your panel. So we're going to talk today about injunctive relief. But before we do, I want to go off script just for a moment and acknowledge that last week was a very interesting week for me after the show on Friday and then this week, of course, following. Well, we had a discussion on permanent alimony last week, and I just want to address that briefly because I had a significant response to that, and that's part of what I'm here for. I mean, obviously, the information dissemination and information sharing with you is very important, and I enjoy doing that. But also part of this show is there's a marketing element to this show, and I'm obviously interested in garnering new clients where and when I can. And the discussion of permanent alimony certainly struck a nerve with a number of people who felt compelled to contact me. And obviously, in addition to my gratitude, I just want to point out that family law attorneys generally deal with alimony issues. I mean, alimony is at any time probably a third of my practice. If I'm handling divorce cases, there's a good chance that I'm handling alimony issues. And depending on the circumstances of if there's businesses involved in the marriage or if there's, you know, business ownership by both spouses, the bottom line, if it's a complex litigation, it generally involves alimony. And permanent alimony being this hot button issue these days, I just want to point out that although we will not always talk about alimony issues on the radio show, it certainly struck my mind that that might be something that I do mention regularly simply because the response was unprecedented in terms of how long I've been doing this show. And so if you have questions regarding permanent alimony issues or alimony issues in general, temporary and whatnot, or if you're thinking about divorce and that's one of the primary issues as you see it, and irrespective of what side of that issue you're on, contact my office and we can talk about it. So that's enough for alimony today. If we have some time at the end, I may go back and revisit a few of the elements that we talked about last week. But we're going to talk about injunctive relief today. And Florida law provides for four distinct types of orders of protection against violence, also commonly known as restraining orders. You've heard that term in the news, on TV. These orders protect a person from domestic, repeat, dating violence, sexual violence. We're going to go over the four different types today because they're actually four distinct types of injunctive relief and really four different types of violence that occur. And obviously this will be a primer on the subject versus, you know, something that we do particularly in depth. But there will be some depth to the procedures that we're going to discuss because that's really what's important to the community. People will go to court for a certain kind of injunctive relief and find out when they get to court in front of a judge that they don't have standing or there's some issue that makes it impossible for them to get the relief that they need based on the procedure. All four types of injunctions are civil proceedings, and in Florida, the family rules of procedure and the Florida rules of evidence apply. The Supreme Court has promulgated forms, and some of these forms are mandatory. So I guess that's the first place to start in terms of what's really important. To ensure statewide uniformity and recognition by law enforcement, all courts are required to use the Supreme Court's temporary injunction and final judgment of injunction forms. Those forms, including the petitions, the various motions, and orders, they're all available online for your viewing, for printing, or for downloading. And, of course, that website is flcourts.org. When filing a case, it's advisable to use the family law rules. Track the statutory language or contact your clerk's office to obtain a copy of the version that you can use in your county. Or you can contact me to handle the matter personally and professionally, and I'll, of course, do that. Historically, there were filing fees associated with these petitions, but you should know that those were eliminated actually many years ago. It was 2003 now. Holy cow, 10 years ago. Once a petition's been filed, it is presented to a judge to consider whether an ex parte temporary injunction that would be valid up to 15 days should be granted. Florida law only requires that the court review the four corners of the petition, basically the document itself, to determine whether there appears to be an immediate and present danger of violence. That initial standard is fairly low or reasonable. I mean, they're just going to look at the document. If it's there, they're going to order it for 15 days. No police reports, no photographs of injuries or other supporting documentation is necessary for that 15-day temporary injunction, and if it is issued, a full evidentiary hearing must be scheduled within that 15-day period. The court may grant a continuance of the hearing for up to an additional 15 days if there's good cause shown for either party, meaning somebody can't make it to the hearing or there's an illness or, you know, some reasonable reason, but that may also include an extension to obtain service of process. The person who is the subject of the injunctive relief, the respondent, has to be served with service of process. If the ex parte temporary injunction is denied because the court finds, for example, that there's no appearance of an immediate and present danger, then a final hearing must be granted. If the temporary injunction is denied because the petition is filed under the incorrect statute, then a motion to amend the correct statute should be filed, which is what we're going to be talking a little bit about today. There's four different types of injunctive relief, and the person has to have a particular standing for that. And we're going to break down what those rules are a little bit, which, of course, may or could lead to other questions, and that's why I'm here. At the final hearing, the petitioner must prove the case by preponderance of the evidence, and as with the temporary injunction, no supporting documentation is required by law, although all admissible evidence should be presented in the situation where you've got your 15-day hearing, I'm sorry, your 15-day injunction, and then we go to the hearing. Basically, the four corners of the document still applies, but there's going to be a hearing. The parties are going to give testimony. They don't have to give all of the possible admissible evidence at that time, but they certainly should. This is another reason why it might be prudent to have an attorney available. That said, domestic violence cases tend to be, well, there's a lot of them. Sometimes at St. Lucie County and even at Martin County, I've been to court on domestic violence days where the judge is hearing those cases, and quite literally.
Domestic violence day.
Well, actually, that's how I think
it. Sounds
of it.
Like a special.
No, yeah, you're
like
right.
They're running a special.
That was kind of glib, wasn't it? Well, let me explain what I mean by that. When I go to a judge's
actually,
calendar.
Actually, I took it there.
You did, but I did. You called me out on it, and that's one of the beauties.
That's why I'm here.
That's exactly right. I'm going to have to take a stop here and explain what I meant by that, because I want this to be clear. I go to a judge's calendar, and I see DV, which just generally means domestic violence. That means the judge has scheduled domestic violence hearings for that day. And there's a reason that they do that. They'll block off half a day or perhaps an entire day. And the reason is because there is a lot of them. There generally, or there can be a lot of them. I've been to court in St. Lucie quite recently where the domestic violence day, I don't recall the judge that was hearing the case, but it's really not relevant, but the domestic violence cases were literally out the door and wrapped around the building. And so I don't know how many of those cases get heard in a given day. I've been involved in domestic violence cases myself, obviously. They last, you know, anywhere 15 minutes, maybe half an hour, depending on the circumstances. But there are literally dozens, if not hundreds, that could be heard in a day, or maybe 100, given the particular circumstances of every case.
Yeah, or the phase of the moon, you know, who got in trouble when.
It could be a phase of the moon that sometimes, depending where the moon's at, that there's going to be a higher number that day.
But I just didn't realize that they would go, okay, we're going to stay on this topic for, you know, let's just do all this on one day. I really didn't realize that's how it worked.
It'll work in those situations for anything, any area of law where there's going to be a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. For example, child support cases. They'll hear them a certain number of days per year. The magistrate or the judge will just block them on their calendar, and there will be dozens of potential cases for that 4 or 8 hour block period. Same with domestic violence. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of there's that many cases, so they have to organize their schedule that way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to final judgments. Final judgments for protection against violence, commonly known as permanent injunctions. They remain in effect until modified or dissolved by the court. Let me explain a little bit about that. A permanent injunction is not permanent in that it's never going away. I say this because I run into this often in family practice, where there is one, or maybe the parties are simply hostile towards one another. And sometimes that hostility bleeds into the realm of unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody hears they've got a permanent injunction, they just have it in their mind that it's permanent and that's the end of it and it's never going to be changed. Well, come on. Sometimes I just think, just grow up, because that is not reality. Permanent means permanent until the judge
changes it.
And as often as I try to explain that sometimes, it just doesn't sink in, which gives us an idea of sometimes the level of hostility that is involved, because deep down people may wish that it was permanent.
Sure.
So that they would have some kind
of
advantage.
Depends on who asked for it.
They're going to want some kind of an advantage with respect to their children, maybe their time sharing, it could be any issue in a case, really. And that doesn't speak to the seriousness of the violence that is or may be a part of the case. It just speaks to a reality that permanent does not mean permanent forever. It means until the judge steps in and makes a decision otherwise.
Does there have to be already violence that has occurred, or could you be afraid of possible violence?
The short answer is that it could be reasonable fear.
Okay.
And so that's going to be a standard that has to be shown through a judge's satisfaction. Mm-hmm. But yes, it doesn't have to be something that has occurred in the past.
Okay.
It could be based on a reasonable
Nothing's
fear.
Happened yet.
Right. But
and we
I genuinely
keep it that
believe
way.
It could be based on behavior or any number of other factors. Absolutely. Injunctions, as we said, they may be extended upon their expiration date. So permanent or not permanent. The bottom line is, if an injunction has a specific date when it's going to end, or at least needs to be reviewed, it can be extended, provided the request to extend is filed prior to the actual expiration. So in other words, you can't extend an injunction the day after it ends. Mm-hmm. In determining whether the injunction should be extended, the occurrence of new violence is not required. The court may consider circumstances leading to the imposition of the original injunction, as well as subsequent events that may cause the petitioner to have continuing reasonable fear that violence is likely to recur in the future. When determining which cause of action is appropriate, a practitioner, be it an attorney case or a non-attorney case, they must first consider standing to file, and standing is based solely upon the relationship between the parties. So we're going to look at the four different types of injunction, the required standing to petition the court, and the elements for each cause of action and the available relief of each. And the first, of course, is domestic violence. Domestic violence is basically any assault, which could be an aggravated assault, battery, aggravated battery, sexual assault, sexual battery, stalking, even aggravated stalking, kidnapping, false imprisonment, or any criminal offense that results in physical injury or death of one family household member by another. Standing to file is conferred upon family or household members, which are defined as spouses, former spouses, kids, persons related by blood or marriage, any person who is residing within a single dwelling with a petitioner as if a family. So not necessarily someone who is family, but someone who is living as though they are family. or a person with whom the petitioner has a child in common, which would be similarly the same thing, regardless of marriage or cohabitation. The petition may be filed in the circuit where the petitioner is currently or temporarily residing, where the respondent resides, of course, or where the domestic violence occurred. This multi-forum setup is basically to allow a victim of violence who may have fled their home county to obtain protection in their county of temporary residence without having to return to the site of the potential danger. The court may issue an ex parte temporary injunction if the required relationship exists and the court finds that there's an immediate and present danger of domestic violence. The petitioner must plead and prove that he or she has been a victim of domestic violence or that there is a reasonable cause to believe that he or she is in imminent danger of becoming a victim. Florida statute is phased disjunctively, which addresses Veronica's question, and which means that only one of the two criteria needs to be satisfied. Either the petitioner has been a victim or a reasonable fear of imminent violence is at hand. So one or the other, and that standard would be applicable for domestic violence. And when determining whether an immediate and present danger exists, the court will consider the totality of the circumstances. They're going to look at the entirety of the case. There are about 10 specific factors that the court will take into account. Let me go over them briefly. These are indicators of elevated danger that include threats of violence, attempts to harm the petitioner, family members or close associates who may have been threatened, restraining petitioner from leaving the home or contacting police. That would be like a form of false imprisonment. Prior orders of protection, injury or killing of a family pet. If the dog has been mutilated or maimed or killed, obviously that's going to be a factor to determine reasonableness of this impending danger. Threats to use a gun or knife, previous criminal history, threats to kidnap or harm the petitioner's children, and destruction of personal property. These will all be factors that a judge or a court will consider when determining whether injunctive relief for domestic violence should lie. If the court enters an ex parte temporary injunction, then the court may award the following requested relief in addition to the standard injunctions against acts of violence and the no contact within 500 feet rule. Everybody's heard that. Exclusive use of a shared dwelling regardless of title. Exclusion of the respondent from the petitioner's residence, from the petitioner's place of employment or school, or other designated places. The judge will have some wide latitude to determine what those places are. These will be places frequented by the petitioner or family or household members. And then temporary custody of minor children and temporary surrender of firearms and ammunition. And that last one's kind of tricky because there will be situations where a person is a rightful gun owner and they have license or they have the proper paperwork for a notice has been provided to the Martin County Sheriff or whoever regarding surrender of firearms and ammunition or regarding the fact that they own firearms and ammunition. So how do you, in certain circumstances, divest yourself of these firearms when it is mandatory that that be done if you are the subject of an injunction? Well, that's a good question, and there are numerous circumstances for addressing that. One way that might be, I don't know if it's creative, but it sort of satisfies the need is to give the guns to another family member, have them out of the residence where the respondent to an injunction lives, keep them in storage or have them in some place where easy access is not necessarily there. Those will satisfy, in most circumstances, the temporary surrender of firearms and ammunition, or of course store them with the sheriff's office in your jurisdiction. I mean, obviously that's going to satisfy it as well. But if there are questions with respect to those issues, obviously competent counsel should be reached so that those issues can be discussed. I've been in courtrooms where the issue of firearms was part of a domestic violence injunction, and there have been interesting, to my thinking, interesting rulings on that particular provision, and competent counsel can address those questions because sometimes it's not as simple as I give up my guns. Maybe they're not even in the person's possession at the time that the injunction lies, but that needs to be addressed because most certainly the petitioner of an injunction is going to want that to be addressed, and so those issues need to be clarified and fleshed out by a court because, like I said, it's absolutely necessary that that issue be resolved as part of any injunctive relief. There's not going to be an exception to that. Now, if a court awards exclusive use of a shared home, provisions are going to be made for the respondent, the person subject to the injunction, to receive items of personal health and hygiene, maybe tools of his or her trade, along with other property that the parties may agree upon. The respondent's going to be allowed to return to the premises to retrieve these items at a designated time, probably in the presence of law enforcement. A member of the sheriff's office or police is going to be there, who will normally stand by for a short period of time, 30 minutes to an hour maybe. The court has no authority to make any equitable distribution of property, so we're not going to address divorce issues as part of injunctive relief. All disputed matters regarding the division or distribution of property must be brought before the court in a normal Chapter 61 family law type case. And we'll get to the moment of which of these types of cases has priority. Domestic violence injunction statute specifically prohibits the entry of any form of mutual injunctions. What that means is separate injunctions may be issued under individual or distinct case numbers in circumstances where each party files for an order of protection and pleads and proves sufficient facts to warrant the entry of an order. So as to the question of can both parties be subject to an injunction, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. They just can't be subject to the same injunction. So we're not going to hear both sides of the story in one injunctive relief hearing. We're going to have separate cases for that, which if you think about it, makes perfect sense. And also, to answer the more general question, there are circumstances where petitioners and respondents can each be petitioners and respondents.
Now, how sticky does that get at the place of residence if they're still living together? I mean, I live here and I'm going to get an order against you. You live here and you're going to get an order against me. Now, who goes?
Well, that's going to be for the court's decision, and that is going to be sticky, but it's also going to be something that they have to address. It's going to have to go one way or another. Mm-hmm. In a situation where both parties are subject to injunctive relief, they're not going to be living together.
Right.
I mean, I've never been part of any sort of a circumstance.
I was thinking it could be a good tool to get them out. If you've got a spouse you want out and they're not going.
Oh, absolutely. It could be a potential tool for that.
Yeah.
I mean, really, all you have to show is the threshold for reasonableness or the fact that it has occurred previously and it could happen. You're getting to the angle of if it's actually there, but it could be used as a tool to get someone out of the house, or at least I think you are, and that's true. That could be done. I mean, getting a 15-day injunctive relief is not particularly difficult. The judge is just going to look at the four corners, see what it says. I'm going to give 15 days, and we'll redress this within the next 2 weeks, which could be implemented as a tool to get someone out. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right about that. And then, of course, down the road at that hearing, we're going to have to flesh out whether or not that injunction needs to be just lifted or quashed. But it's still a good tool, potentially effective tool. No question about that. Violations of the injunction by the respondent, and we'll flesh out more of this on the other side of the break, but I'll say real quickly, those violations may include refusing to vacate a shared dwelling, returning to a shared dwelling, coming within 500 feet of a petitioner's home after that has been implemented, coming to their place of employment or other designated place, you know, some element of stalking or potential stalking that may be part of that. Even telephoning, contacting, or otherwise communicating with the petitioner, directly or indirectly. Committing any act of domestic violence against a petitioner, obviously. And or having any firearms in that person's possessions. Those are all first-degree criminal misdemeanors if those violations occur. And that's a significant violation. Other violations, such as failure to pay ordered support, we'll talk about on the back end of the break. This is attorney Michael Raybuck, and you are listening to Raybuck Law Firm Radio on AM 1590 WPSL.
This is WPSL Port St. Lucie, the talk of the Treasure Coast.
FNN News, I'm Deborah Roberts. For the past 3 years, the Florida House of Representatives has killed every effort to ban texting behind the wheel, but not this time. Representative Doug Holder presented his bill to the House Transportation Subcommittee on Thursday.
This includes texting, emailing, and instant messaging with another person. It does not include brief interactions with navigation or other equipment, nor conversations facilitated without typing or writing.
And when Holder was done, no one argued against the bill. The text ban was approved on a unanimous vote, and backers of the bill are starting to believe this may be the year it finally becomes law. How concerned should we be about the rise of so-called nightmare bacteria, strains that are resistant to even the strongest antibiotics? Dr. Glenn Morris, who heads up the University of Florida's Emerging Pathogens Department, says we're not at the crisis point yet, but
we continue to be in situation, you know, have increasing problems in finding antibiotics that can treat serious infections. And this becomes particularly serious for patients who are in and out of the hospital a lot, who have underlying serious illness, who have had multiple courses of antibiotics.
Dr. Morris says we need to guard against misuse and overuse of antibiotics he calls a very precious resource. Authorities say a man was fatally shot by Jacksonville SWAT officers who'd been trying to help him after his truck crashed while ramming another car off the road. An officer shot the man after police say he went for his gun after at first cooperating with the three officers yesterday afternoon. And thousands of people and bikers from across the world are making their way to Daytona Beach today for the 72nd Annual Bike Week. It's the best-known biker rally in the nation and one of the longest, too, running through March 17th. This year, Bike Week includes events that span beyond Daytona and into DeLand and Orlando. But with the increase in motorcycle traffic comes an increase in motorcycle accidents. The death toll peaked in 2000 with 20 fatal crashes involving motorcycle riders. With news on the Florida News Network, I'm Deborah Roberts.
The problem with traditional lawn weed killers? New weeds keep coming back, and you have to treat them again and again. It's frustrating and costly, but one simple application of Bayer Advanced Season-Long Weed Control for lawns kills current weeds and prevents new weeds for up to 6 months. Apply anytime, spring through fall, and spend more time enjoying your lawn and less time weeding it. Bayer Advanced. Better science, better results. BayerAdvanced.com. Always read and follow label directions. See product label for Kill and Prevent Weed List.
Did you know that colon cancer screening saves lives? Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in Florida. But more than 90% of all cases of colon cancer can be prevented with regular screening. Did you know that you have a choice of colon cancer screening options? If you're 50 or older, talk to your doctor about which colon cancer screening test is right for you. Plan to be colon cancer free for life. To learn more, visit coloncancerfl.org. A message from the Florida Department of Health.
The FAA is threatening to close the control towers of 189 small airports around the country to save money because of sequestration, including 20 here in Florida. Rich Lesniak of Albert Whitted Airport in downtown St. Pete says that wouldn't be a smart move to save money. His airport is on the hit list.
Albert Whitted resides in an urbanized, highly densely populated area. The Tampa Bay area is a fairly complex airspace. We're adjacent to MacDill. We're adjacent to Tampa International, St. Pete Clearwater International, and you have a lot of airspace that's crisscrossing Albert Whitted.
Lesniak says the city of St. Pete is sending a letter to the FAA appealing that decision. And Busch Gardens in Tampa has a new baby aardvark. The infant was born February 6, but keepers still don't know its sex. Busch Gardens says the healthy baby is expected to grow to more than 120 pounds within its first year of life. Aardvarks are solitary by nature, and aardvark births are not common. For more news you care about, go to myflanews.com. I'm Deborah Roberts, FNN News.
You're listening to the Ray Buck Law Firm Radio Hour on WPSL 1590. Now back to your host, attorney Michael Ray Buck.
Welcome back. This is Michael Ray Buck. You're listening to Ray Buck Law Firm Radio on AM 1590 WPSL. For questions about family law matters or personal injury cases, call me for a free consultation at 772-600-8166. You may also email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com. Visit our website, thefamilylawattorney.net. You can email me there as well, and you can find our links on the website to Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Ray Buck Radio replays. We are discussing injunctive relief today and domestic violence and the other violences recognized under Florida law. We were talking about violations of an injunction by a respondent, such as refusing to vacate and other issues. And those, we'd indicated that things like having any firearms in respondent's possession after an injunction has been implemented are first-degree criminal misdemeanors. And a first-degree criminal misdemeanor is, you know, that has some weight to it. There could be a criminal fine that would include imprisonment up to a year if a person is found guilty of those violations. But other violations, such as failure to pay ordered support, failing to attend court-ordered counseling or violation of visitation orders. These may all result in contempt. Contempt of court charges, which may include jail time or sanctions, sometimes significant sanctions, to include attorney's fees. Certain violations of the injunction, such as intentionally crossing a state line to violate an injunction, causing an intimate partner to cross state lines by force or fraud and causing bodily injury to that person, that would violate an injunction. And interstate stalking, these are also crimes under the Federal Violence Against Women Act. There will be particular sanctions for those, sometimes very clearly delineated in that federal statute. And so it would be very beneficial for someone who is potentially looking at those charges or those violations to speak with an attorney to come in and get proper counsel for how to handle those issues. I should also say that even if the petitioner or a third party does something manipulative or maybe just inadvertently, invites the respondent to come to a residence where he's been excluded or otherwise into contact with the petitioner, well, that's a violation of the injunction. So the bottom line is if the injunction is in place, don't violate it, no matter what the circumstances are. Petitioners who initiate contact with the respondent cannot be charged with violating the injunction. The injunctive relief is not against the petitioner. It is for the petitioner's benefit. Stretch that out to its logical conclusion. A petitioner could manipulate a situation where a respondent is induced into violating and then using that information against the respondent. And guess what happens if you go to court under those circumstances? The respondent is likely going to lose. All right, so be very mindful. The injunction is particular to the respondent. It is not really, it doesn't subject the petitioner to its rules. If a petitioner makes contact, the respondent should make a motion to dissolve the injunction or dismiss the case. But I should state that that's not always grounds for dismissal. The bottom line is if a petitioner reaches out to respondent, if a respondent is my client and he contacts me or he or she contacts me and says, what should I do? I would say file for a dismissal because the petitioner clearly does not feel threatened by you anymore and we can make that case.
I'm sure like cell phone records are real helpful because everything is documented. You know, like if you called somebody, you can't just say, no, I really didn't call you, because there it is.
Yep.
You know, who initiated the phone call? Well, there it is. It's all right there.
And we'll use cell phone contact or cell phone records all the time for these types of hearings. And on the other side of that, let's just look at a situation where someone's been induced, where a petitioner has contacted a respondent numerous times. Now, the court's not going to do anything about that. But the court will look at the record to determine the level of inducement, to determine in some cases that a respondent was simply, although they were wrong and they're in violation of the injunction, there's going to be a sanction for it. There may be some mitigation to that, given the fact of the petitioner's behavior. But the bottom line is, that's not typical. If a respondent is reached out to by a petitioner, the parties of an injunction move to have it dismissed before you ever do anything like go to their house.
Right.
Because it's just it's like contempt. If you violate what the court says to do, you're going to be contempted and that's going to carry a sanction. And it doesn't matter if it's well-meaning or it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. If you violate the terms of the order, you're going to have to deal with the court on that because the court's going to look at you sideways and ask, what were you thinking? And that's just simply what's going to happen. And any attorney who tells you otherwise, talk to multiple attorneys. Because the bottom line is that judges will not favor people who violate their orders. The injunctive relief, which may be awarded in a permanent injunction against domestic violence, includes the same provisions for protection against violence and include injunctions against contact and acts of violence, award of temporary visitation, child support, spousal support, ordering the respondent to attend certified batterers intervention programs, parenting classes, substance abuse possibilities, or other counseling. And there's a mandatory prohibition against possession of firearms and ammunition that we've talked about. And it's very important to just reiterate it. Sometimes I find myself just saying the same things over and over again because of their importance. Best interest of the child. Don't have firearms if you're subject to an injunction. Mm-hmm. I say these things simply because it's absolutely imperative that you do that because I see it all the time. I see the types of the violations that occur and the heavy sanctions that follow. So it's important to have that information if you're going into that situation in court. Both federal and Florida law make it a crime for a respondent to possess any firearm or ammunition while subject to a qualifying order of protection against domestic violence. And that means if you have a restraining order against you, don't have a firearm. It's that simple. Surrender of all personal firearms is mandatory, although law enforcement officers, such as those defined by Florida statutes, sheriffs, police officers, they may keep their service weapons while on official duty unless otherwise prohibited by the employing law enforcement agency. Now, what did I just say? Sheriff's officers and police officers may also be subject to injunctions. There's no question about that. It does happen. But in those cases, if they're in the course of their professional duties, they may, under the circumstances of their employer, carry a firearm for purposes of their employment. There's no statutory authority for an award of attorney's fees in an injunction proceeding, in case anyone was interested. How can I get fees out of this? But neither trial nor appellate fees may be awarded under any theory, and that would include 57-105, which is a statute that attorneys sometimes employ when something frivolous has been filed or may reasonably be deemed frivolous. Attorneys go after attorney's fees on the other side. Sometimes petitioners or respondents go after fees from the attorney and or their client based on the fact that the parties, including the attorneys, should have known or did know that the action was frivolous. 57-105 is basically there to sort of clean up the court's docket, because if something frivolous is filed, attorneys should not be in the practice and habit of filing things that they know are frivolous. I mean, they should not be using those things for leverage or for any other reason. But that grievance statute is not relevant for purposes of injunctive relief.
The sad thing is, though, people lie. I mean, the attorney may think they're doing the right thing.
Well, an attorney may believe that they're doing the right thing, and that will be fleshed out at a 57-105 hearing. If it turns out that what has been done is in fact frivolous, the court's going to have to look at it and say, do I believe, based on what the parties are telling me, that this is a frivolous action? And then look at, did the attorney reasonably believe what they were being told? I have to tell you, very rarely do attorneys become subject to 57-105s. I would say that there has to be some sort of a pattern of their practice that would allow that to lie in circumstances. I mean, you know, it's like any other business. You become familiar with the people that you're working with. And I can only speak generally to this because I've not had any experience with it, and I have not seen it as a third party looking at other people who practice. But it's there for a reason, and there are attorneys who will be subject to 57-105s from time to time, and that's, I think, what we're generally talking about. Yes, people will lie, and they will do these frivolous things, and they'll get sanctioned for it. That's probably relatively common in pro se matters where there's no attorneys. But there are circumstances where there'll be attorneys who just are known for doing stuff that are sort of on the cusp. Judges know this, and if they see over and over again, there will come a point where they'll just be like, you know, enough. And that's just me being anecdotal. I can't stay with any specificity, but that's why it's there. And it does happen.
As you mentioned, like in the event of a police officer, because this would be a real good tool to hurt your ex if that's what you want to do, because that's their job.
Yes. There are numerous tools that can be utilized for those types of purposes. Here's a common example. Filing a DCF report with the Department of Children and Families, making a claim that something occurred, which may or may not have occurred, and investing all of that time getting an investigator to go out into the field and do the research and interview the parties and perhaps the children who've been claimed to have been subject to some sort of maybe domestic violence or maybe just some
abuse
neglect.
Yeah.
Only to find out that there's nothing to substantiate it. And then that goes on and on, and it becomes sort of part of the case. Suddenly you've got 5 or 7 DCF reports, all of them unsubstantiated, and the investigators are going, we recommend that the children need some counseling here because they've been interviewed by us 7 times, and now we have a concern that there's a problem. The injunctive relief is the same type of thing. And there are litigants out there who will exploit and utilize and mine these resources for, like you said, they're not necessarily above board. They're manipulations. And the civil court, I'm not going to say that it's allowable, but it's something that can be done because the court has to go through this process. I mean, the court has to take these claims very seriously because the presumption is that they're serious.
Sure.
The flip side of that, this is actually really good information. It's good that we're talking about it. I mean, I'm actually interested in hearing myself talk today, and that's a rarity. It really is. No. The court will become familiar with that after a while. They'll see, okay, frivolous, or we denied all these motions. And you know what's going to happen is the court's going to become jaded
sure.
for one side of this litigation. And so you pick your poison. Mm-hmm. And we could probably go on and on about this, but you're absolutely right. This can be used for those types of purposes, even if it's not necessarily above board or appropriate. Mm-hmm. You can use this for all sorts of leverage. Florida injunctions are enforceable in all counties of the state and, believe it or not, actually nationwide. A qualifying final order of protection against domestic violence issued by a court of a foreign state must be accorded full faith and credit by the courts of Florida and enforced by law enforcement as if they were Florida court orders. This is a way that Florida has a form of comity or reciprocity with other states to enforce that state's rules. I'm often reminded of this because as a member of the Florida bar, you don't get to wave into other members of other bars. Florida doesn't have comity or reciprocity, so I can't go to North Carolina or Wyoming and get my bar license without mm-hmm. taking the bar exam.
Right.
But in this instance, Florida does have comity with things like, really with a lot of different family issues, and injunctive relief is one of those. So anywhere an injunction, injunctive relief can be enforced by Florida. So let's look at a second form of violence, and that's repeat violence, which is a little bit different than just the standard domestic violence, in that a petitioner who does not have a domestic relationship, as defined by the Florida statute, may be eligible to obtain an injunction for protection under the repeat violence statute. Since the enactment of laws providing for protection against dating and sexual violence, repeat violence cases have become mostly like love triangle cases, new girlfriend versus old girlfriend, former husband versus new husband, that kind of thing. Employer, employee, and coworker relationships, schoolmates, neighborhood disputes, and roommates who don't have a dating and intimate relationship. Any person who's a victim of repeat violence or who's the parent or legal guardian of a minor child living at home who is the victim of repeat violence now has standing to file for an injunction against repeat violence. In repeat violence cases, the petitioner must plead and prove that he or she's been a victim of two instances of violence or stalking. Violence, of course, as we've stated, it's any assault or aggravated assault, battery, kidnapping, false imprisonment, any criminal offense resulting in physical injury or death. One of the incidents of violence or stalking must have occurred within 6 months of the filing of the petition and must be directed against the petitioner or the petitioner's immediate family member. The standard of relief here is what's different than that in domestic violence cases. In DV cases, no acts of violence need to have occurred prior to the filing if the petitioner has a reasonable fear that, you know, violence is imminent. But in repeat violence cases, not only must the violence have occurred already, but there must have been two acts of violence or a stalking in order for the relief to be warranted. No matter how egregious the violence may be, if it is simply one act, the petition is going to fail. So repeat violence has particular parameters. You don't file a repeat violence injunction or for an injunction if it's a domestic violence injunction, because you're not going to get it if all you have is reasonable fear. Believe it or not, that can be an issue. I mean, that happens. If you bring the wrong type of violence injunctive relief to the court, it's going to be denied and you have to start the process over again. The following circumstances have been found insufficient for issuance of repeat violence injunctions. Telephone threats by themselves, receiving unwanted letters and flowers, non-threatening emails, non-threatening phone messages, chance encounters at restaurants, and leaving notes, cards, and a rose on petitioner's doorstep, even after the petitioner had clearly indicated she wanted no further contact. So the point is, there is a standard for repeat violence that has to be met, and certain elements that we may believe constitute that aren't going to fly. And simply because those instances may only be creating a reasonable fear, which would be a different standard for a different type of injunctive relief. On the other hand, repeated videotaping of a neighbor constituted stalking for purposes of the issuance of a repeat violence injunction. And remember, stalking is one of the things that you can show. It doesn't have to be violence. It could be violence and a stalking. And if something can be deemed stalking, that's going to count for repeat violence.
I like that. Repeated videotaping of a neighbor.
Yeah.
For what?
Great question. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe they just
like
the neighbor.
Why would you be doing this?
Yeah. What weird reason do you have for videotaping your neighbor while they're
out on
the lawn?
The neighbor should be looking for a new place to live.
Yeah, exactly. Also, barking dogs coupled with threats were found sufficient where a petitioner was substantially and unreasonably disturbed. That was also deemed stalking. So that would qualify. Relief in a repeat violence injunction may include injunctions from committing acts of violence, ordering the respondent to appropriate counseling, other relief that's necessary for protection of the petitioner. There's no requirement that the court record the final hearing in any of these injunction proceedings. So counsel of the parties may wish to bring a court reporter. That's important for purposes of review, judicial or otherwise. It would be encouraged if I were representing someone, I would discuss the possibility of paying for a court reporter to make sure that we had an appropriate and sworn statement as to the record. Third violence is dating violence, and I'll try to cut through these quickly because I know we're short on time, as usual. The legislature created a cause of action for protection against dating violence about 11 years ago. Any person who's the victim of dating violence or the parent or legal guardian of a minor child living at home who's the victim of dating violence now has standing to file for an injunction under this section. Dating violence is essentially any violence between individuals who have or had a continuing and significant relationship, romantic, intimate, like that. Despite the fact that the cause of action for an injunction against dating violence is contained in the statutes, the law provides that persons in dating relationships must meet the same statutory criteria as is required for issuance of an injunction against domestic violence. The petitioner is a victim of dating violence or has a reasonable belief that it's imminent. No acts of violence need to have occurred prior to filing. So obviously that sounds a lot like domestic violence, but it's qualified in that it's not that particular standard. There's no actual living together type thing. Because the dynamics of a dating relationship are the same in traditional domestic relationships, the standard for protection is also the same. The three factors for the court in considering determining whether the dating relationship exists basically are: the relationship existed within the past 6 months, the relationship was characterized by the expectation of affection or perhaps sexual involvement, and the frequency and type of interaction that the persons were involved in over time and on a continuous basis during the course of that time. A dating relationship does not exist where contact between the parties has been that of a causal acquaintance or a casual acquaintance or ordinary fraternization like in a business setting or maybe social context. And while the standard for issuance of the injunction is the same as the domestic violence statute, the available injunctive relief is actually that of repeat violence. The court may award injunctions against acts of violence, referrals to appropriate counseling, or other orders that are basically the same as in repeat violence situations. And then finally, we have sexual violence, and this became effective in 2003 when the Victims Freedom Act became law and created a cause of action under injunction against sexual violence. Sexual violence is one incident of sexual battery, a lewd or lascivious act committed upon or in the presence of a person younger than 16, or any forcible felony where a sexual act is committed or even attempted. A person who is the victim of sexual violence or the parent or legal guardian of a minor child living at home who is the victim of an act of sexual violence has standing to file. The petitioner must have reported the incident to law enforcement and must be cooperating in any criminal proceeding against the respondent, or if the respondent was sentenced to a term of imprisonment for that act, the sentence must have expired or be due to expire within 90 days. If the respondent is incarcerated, the temporary injunction is effective for 15 days following release from incarceration rather than 15 days from the date of issuance as with the other protective injunctions. So you can see why we're delineating the different types of violence. There's just a different mechanism for how it's implemented in this particular case. But the final hearing must be set prior to expiration of the temporary injunction. Authority to serve an injunction for protection against sexual violence upon an incarcerated respondent shifts from the law enforcement officer to a state prison correctional officer. If the respondent is not served before release, then the copies will be forwarded to the sheriff of the county where the offender was or is going to be released. This category of protection, this order, was created to provide protection for persons, including minors, of course, who are victims of one act of sexual violence but have no domestic or dating relationship with the perpetrator. Previously, the only remedy available was the repeat violence statute where two acts are required. This new enactment closes that gap in protection for sex crime victims. In other words, the two requirements is no longer necessary. It's just a single act is required for establishment of the violence injunction, sex violence injunction. And the relief available is the same as in repeat violence cases, which we've gone over. So that summarizes the four types of injunctive orders for protection against violence in Florida. If you have questions with respect to those issues, certainly contact me at the office. I'll give my number before we end today. But that is the summary of injunctive relief. Veronica, did you have other questions with respect to that?
I do have a question as far as from state to state. If you're in, say, you're here in Florida and you have a relative that may be out of state that you fear will come, can you get an order against them if you have fear of that person?
Yeah, if there is a reason
to keep them away from you. I mean, who cares if they come to the state, but as long as they're not coming around you.
The answer is actually yes, because if there is a reasonable basis for it, then the court will order it.
Now, will they be notified in that other state that this?
Well, they have
occurred?
To be served. Yes, okay. They have to be served, and so that will have to take place. And once that's done, it's really just a matter of establishing the case. And under your hypothetical, mm-hmm. I would have to say that the answer is yes. If reasonableness can be established, that injunction will lie. I guess it could be a situation where you're living on a state on a border of one state or another. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a factor in making that determination. I suppose if somebody lives over in Washington State, there's going to be a little bit higher burden of proof for the person mm-hmm. who's trying to prove it to show that that's actually reasonable.
Right.
But it's certainly within the realm of possibility that it could be reasonable. Maybe the person you're talking about in your hypothetical is very wealthy and can fly over here mm-hmm. and be here in 6 hours.
Or there may be a reason why they would come.
Or there might be a reason that they don't come. Or you know that they are coming, and you mm-hmm. know that they're coming for a purpose that you believe malicious or
right.
otherwise.
Okay.
And so, yes, absolutely.
But they would be notified in that state.
Well, they would have to be served, yes. There would mm-hmm. have to be proper service. I mean, the judge is going to look at that and say, was service properly executed in this case to make that determination.
Now, the other question I have, too, is if you are served, you know, you have an order against you, how does that affect you in your day-to-day life? I mean, if you go to apply for credit, if you go to, you know, do anything that they run a check on, does it affect you?
Something like a credit check would probably not be affected.
Background check for a job, maybe?
Well, that may. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Especially on what kind of job.
Yeah, I mean, if it's permanent or temporary, I guess whether it is permanent or temporary would be irrelevant, because if the bottom line is if the potential employer does a review of the local county where you're living or wherever the injunction may lie, they will see that, and that could become a part of whether or not you get a job. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It could very well be.
Okay.
Employers have rights to hire who they want to hire as well.
And now you use the word permanent. How long that's going to stay there until something is changed by a judge.
Yes, a permanent injunction is not permanent in that just because it's indicated as permanent that it's going to last forever. Mm-hmm. It is permanent in that it is permanent until the court deems it otherwise.
Okay, and is there an expiration on them, or you have to go to court and ask for that to be changed?
Both of those are true.
Okay.
There will be a judge who will state that this is going to be operative for 1 year or 6 months or 90 days, but it's permanent until such time that at that date elapses or we revisit the issue.
Okay.
Or it could just be permanent until further notice. Circumstances would be a little bit more narrow under that circumstance, but it could certainly happen. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there have certainly been injunctions issued that had no drop dead date, so to speak.
So you would ask the judge, you know, for, you know, please let it be last at least a year, or does that work, or does the judge just decide?
It will depend on the particulars of the case. Typically, the judges will have their own standards for that. In a lot of cases, the judge will just make that decision. Mm-hmm. They'll state, and a lot of times they'll just state, this is what it's going to be. This is Attorney Michael Raybuck. You have been listening to Raybuck Law Firm Radio today, where we discussed injunctive relief and a little bit about alimony at the very beginning of the hour. If you have questions with respect to anything regarding a family in all nature, perhaps you need litigation assistance with respect to your upcoming divorce, or perhaps other issues regarding establishment or a timesharing or maybe a modification of an existing divorce decree, contact me at the office. My phone number is 772-600-8166. I'd be more than happy to give you a free 30-minute consultation with respect to your case. We also handle personal injury cases and would be more than happy to speak with you regarding negligence involving acts or inactiveness regarding another person who may be responsible for your injuries. I can be located on the web at thefamilylawattorney.net. We've got Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, all of those things linked right up to our website. This has been Michael Raybuck. Thank you very much and have a great weekend.
CBS News is next on WPSL Port St. Lucie, the talk of the Treasure Coast, a service of Port St. Lucie broadcasters.
CBS News, I'm Steve Kathan. Good employment news from the government. 236,000 jobs created last month, and the jobless rate fell from 7.9% to 7.7%.
This really blew away every expectation, much better than expected.
Jill Schlesinger of CBS.